Good evening, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king, but in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Garland Favorito, and we're going to be talking about his book, Our Nation Betrayed, From Impeachment to Infinite War, by Garland Favorito. And so it's a fascinating book because it's really a review of the last 12 years of American history, told from the point of view of a gentleman who really just woke up recently to the fact that there was a real problem. And as he describes the events of starting in the early 90s, perhaps 92 or so, why, of course, there are events I lived through, and many of the people he talks about are events that I personally experienced. And when he talks about my friend Pat Matriciano and the fact that his office was infiltrated by agents of the FBI, pretending to be his friends, but really they're planted there to disrupt the operation of his office. And, of course, you have to realize that you never know who you can trust today, because they may well be government agents. And I knew these people who were there, and I knew that they were government agents. And I tried to warn Pat that he was being betrayed. And Pat is such a nice guy. He trusted these people, and he wouldn't listen to me or anybody else. And, of course, it caused him, destroyed his life in many ways. And this is what the government does when you become an enemy of the state. And so it's really so fascinating material in this book. Garland, thank you so much for writing the book and for being our guest this evening.
Well, Stan, thank you so much for having me on and inviting me. It's a real honor to be on your show.
Well, of course, you talk about so many people I know, and you talk about John Hillier. I knew John. I had him on a guest many times. He was a former NBC cameraman who saw the drug smuggling that was going on in Arkansas under the Clinton administration there when Clinton was governor. And John Hillier wanted to expose this and was did a lot of investigation, helped Pat Matriciana put out some films, and ended up, of course, he knew that they were going to kill him. And, of course, they did kill him. I firmly believe he was murdered. He was a young, healthy individual who just drops over dead from a heart attack. But that happens so often to people who are into this battle who don't have the Lord's protection. So why don't you tell your story of how you happened to get involved in this whole incredible story and then set out writing a book to try to inform the American people that we are being betrayed. We're being betrayed by powerful forces working within both political parties, leading America into eternal war.
Okay, well, thank you, Stan. It's kind of a long story, and I'll try to summarize as best I can, but I was fairly naive in around about just 92 or so, and probably the first thing that started to wake me up was the 30th anniversary of the JFK assassination, and I realized that John F. Kennedy was not actually, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald really did not fire the fatal shot that killed John F. Kennedy.
Well, if he had, of course, why would the government still have all those records classified? Why would the government do everything they could to prevent the truth from coming out all these years after John Fitzgerald Kennedy was killed? The same thing is, why are they still suppressing all the information on 9/11? Is it that we don't want Osama bin Laden to learn? Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, of course, is Garland Favorito, and you go ahead and tell your story. You began to wake up then when, of course, you began to look back on the Kennedy assassination back about 1963. Of course, this was 1993. You first became aware that something was seriously wrong. So pick the story up from there, Garland.
That's right, and probably I realized it was probably the book by Jim Garrison that did it for me, and that's he had said that J. Edgar Hoover had switched the slides of, I think it was slide 314 and 315 of the Zapruder film to make Kennedy's head look like it went forward instead of backwards. To make it look like the fatal shot came from the Texas School Book Depository when in reality it came from the grassy knoll. And I just didn't believe that Jim Garrison was telling the truth there, so I was at the time working at Coca-Cola as a contractor, went across the street to Georgia Tech Library and looked up the reference that he had in the House Select Committee assassination investigation. And sure enough, it was right there, the testimony by Robert Groden, in that investigation that the slides were switched. So that kind of clued me into that something was kind of wrong in America, but I kind of went on about my business still fairly naively, and then the Vince Foster murder came along, and I noticed that Foster, you know, who they had said committed suicide, did not even have his prints on the gun that was used to kill him.
He made him wipe the prints off after he shot himself. Something like that. A pretty logical explanation. Now, there were so many problems with that assassination. You know, it's very obvious that he was murdered elsewhere. He was moved into the park. And then, of course, everything was done to intimidate anybody who knew what was going on. I talked to a man who was in the park that day, and, of course, what the FBI did to intimidate him. You know, it's a crime to intimidate a witness, but the FBI intimidated him, and nothing was ever done to those FBI people. I talked to Chris Ruddy. I talked to Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who were actually with this fellow when he was accosted by these people who were paid by the FBI to intimidate him. And they would walk down the street, and these people would stop and take pictures and stare at them. And over and over and over again, these people would run ahead, you know, everything to do to frighten him to death so he wouldn't testify honestly at the upcoming a grand jury hearing. Well, when the government is conspiring and doing dishonest things, who do you report it to? But they had to cover up the murder of Vince Foster because it went right into the White House itself.
Well, that's right. And the thing that triggered me there, Stan, was that,
Hold that thought. We're bringing our stations back with us.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Garland Favorito, and he's written a wonderful book, which I'm just in the process of reading, called Our Nation Betrayed, From Impeachment to Infinite War. And he's telling a little the things that woke him up. The first thing that woke him up was the realization that we hadn't been told the truth about the assassination of John Kennedy, and the realization that J. Edgar Hoover had actually switched some of the slides or other frames in the Zapruder film, which he was able to verify, and that bothered him. But even more, as he began looking into the background of Vince Foster, the murder of Vince Foster, and what was it about the murder of Vince Foster that made you realize that we were being lied to by the media?
Well, aside from the fact that he could not have had his prints on the gun that was used to kill him, you know, if he committed suicide, then the other thing that bothered me was that he was a childhood friend of Bill Clinton, and I didn't understand why Bill Clinton did not want to find out who killed him, and he was willing to buy the suicide story. And that bothered me, and then I ended up meeting Linda Ives, the mother of Kevin Ives, who was killed on the train tracks down in Arkansas. And we had a whole lot of phony and death rulings there by the medical examiner that I'm sure you're well aware of. And that led me to believe, and as I traced those down and verified that they were actually accurate, the tracks, as you've mentioned, did go right back into the Clinton governor's office there. And at that point in time, that and other evidence that was building up, I decided that I needed to get involved, and I wanted to conduct what was the first ever national impeachment town hall.
All right, now for our listeners, why there was drugs being smuggled into MENA airport. This was a CIA center, and the CIA was involved in smuggling the drugs. But there were a couple of boys. One of them was Kevin Ives, and who was the other one?
Don Henry.
And of course, they apparently had witnessed the drugs being dropped or a payoff or something of the sort. Anyway, they were brutally murdered, probably by some people in the local police. All the evidence points in that direction. And then everything bodies were left on the railway track. They were run over by a train. The idea was to make everybody believe that they had been killed by the train. But they were killed, obviously, beforehand. Now, there was falsification of the autopsies. And this led to quite a scandal because the parents of these boys weren't about to let it die. They wanted to find out who would kill their boys and why. And, of course, it led right on into the local police. It led right up to the governor's office. That was a scandal at MENA Airport. And, of course, so this is then begins to get Garland very interested, realizing that the governor is covering up for this MENA drug smuggling operation that probably is a CIA operation. So go ahead and tell the story.
Well, and you mentioned the key point there, Stan, was that at the time I did not realize it was a CIA operation. But as you said, the evidence all traced right back into the Clinton governor's office and some local and state authorities there that were involved in the operation. And I was wondering, well, why are the Republicans bringing out this evidence that they are holding over Bill Clinton?
So what's so interesting, just as an aside, we actually have in our four-tape set, which is called Is There Really a War on Drugs, a clip where Sarah McLennan, who's a White House reporter, is asking at a White House press conference, you actually hear the voices, she says to Bill Clinton, well, what about this drug operation there at MENA Airport? Now, they're trying to say, there's this drug operation at MENA Airport. I want you to bring out the truth. And Bill Clinton says, well, that wasn't me. That was a federal government operation. Now, this is the President of the United States there at the White House press conference saying the drug operation at MENA Airport was a federal operation. It wasn't me. Go ahead, pick up
the story. That's exactly right. And that's when I really started to wake up and realize that it was, in fact, a federal operation. It was Central Intelligence Agency involved, and that it was not the only one. There was a whole series of Central Intelligence Agency drug operations that had been going on throughout the world for several decades, and they all seemed to trace back to one source, who they all actually reported back through to George H.W. Bush, who was on hitting these various operations at various times when he was Vice President of the United States and involved in the CIA prior to that.
And, of course, he was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency back in the mid-1970s, mm-hmm. Then becomes the Vice President of the United States, and is really supervising so much of the drug operations, the Iran-Contra things. All of these dishonest and illegal activities could be traced directly to the man who was really running the Reagan administration. His name was George Herbert Walker Bush. That's really part of the establishment, Skull and Bones, Trilateral Commission, Bilderbergers, Director of the Council on Foreign Relations, the whole ball of wax.
That's exactly right. And you mentioned the Skull and Bones, which is probably a good, interesting topic to discuss, because both of our presidential candidates this year are Skull and Bones members by their own admissions.
But neither one of them will discuss it, because both of them have said why this secret society belonged to is too secret to discuss. And I would simply ask, where is their real allegiance then? To our Constitution, to openness, or to the secret society that they belong to that's too secret to discuss?
And that's exactly right. And the question that the media refuses to ask them is, well, why is Skull and Bones a secret? So I decided to find out why it was a secret, and what I found out, it didn't take long, was that the Skull and Bones members have profited from war and drug trafficking since its inception in 1833 and its incorporation in 1856. And the founder was William Huntington Russell. His cousin, Sam Russell, owned Russell and Company, which ran opium into China under the protection of the British government and created the opium wards back in the 1850s and 1860s. So that's the history of Skull and Bones, just briefly. And these individuals, Bush and Kerry, have facilitated this agenda. The Bushes have facilitated it for decades, the agenda of war and drug trafficking.
Andrew, I think you have to explain how they've been involved in war. This starts George W., but not even his father was involved in the first Gulf War. But what about his grandfather? What part did he play in wars, creating wars and financing from them?
Profiting,
I should say.
Excellent question, and I'm sure you already know the answer. Prescott Bush, George W.'s grandfather, was actually ran companies for Averell Harriman, and he had five separate companies that he ran that all had their assets seized in 1942 under the Trading with the Enemy Act, because they were funding and profiting from the rise to power of the Nazis.
And, of course, this, of course, was the fact trading with the enemy, and Prescott Bush was indicted for his involvement not only prior to the Second World War, but during the Second World War, of working and helping to finance the Nazis and holding the Nazi move money and Brown Brothers Harriman, which, of course, he was a partner in.
Absolutely. And his father even was involved, to Samuel P. Bush, to some extent, with the Rockefellers as a liaison on the War Industry Board. But Prescott actually created the family wealth. And many people think that the Bushes got their money from oil. But in reality, they did not. Prescott Bush had established that fortune through funding and profiting from the Nazi rise to power and working for Averell Harriman, who was a fellow Skull and Bones member, Bonesman.
All right. Well, what about the Skull and Bones? What is the real purpose of Skull and Bones? Have you gotten into that? I mean, and why do they have the Nazi memorabilia there in the tomb?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Stan, and I don't have a rock solid answer on that one, because I was primarily concentrating on the history and the various members and their activities that have gone on, and how they facilitated the agenda of war and drug trafficking. We talked about Prescott Bush, we talked about George H.W. Bush, and of course in the case of George W. Bush, it is pretty well established now that this president invaded Iraq under pretenses known to be false prior to the invasion.
But of course that was the same thing with his father and the attack of Saddam after he invaded Kuwait, because his ambassador, as you point out in your book, April Glaspie, President Bush's ambassador, April Glaspie, had told Saddam, we are not concerned about your border dispute with Iraq. In essence, inviting him to go ahead and invade, and as soon as he invaded, why, we immediately went to war over there on the guise that we wanted to restore democracy in Kuwait. We didn't destroy democracy. We reinstalled the Islamic totalitarian dictatorship there.
That's right. And there were a variety of deceptions that they used to do that for that invasion. One was to deceive the Saudis into believing that Iraq was prepared to attack them, and they showed them false photographs of how Saddam's troops were massing on the border of Kuwait and prepared to invade Saudi Arabia, and that is why Saudi Arabia allowed us to set up a base there. That was all later proven to be false.
And, of course, the other thing was the story that they told here in the United States. This woman, a girl, testified before Congress about how the wicked Iraqi troops had come into the nurseries there in Kuwait and thrown the babies on the floor to steal the incubators. And it was all contrived. But I knew that. I remember within 1 or 2 days after Saddam had invaded there, why we were seeing books all across America, already printed, already to tell you why we had to go to war for the first Gulf War. And, of course, it was a very successful war. We only lost 100 men. But now, of course, 300,000 are ill. Another 10,000 have died or more from the experiments that were carried out on our men during George W. Bush, Herbert Walker Bush's first Gulf War. We'll be back in just a moment here with our very special guest, Carolyn Fervorino. Now, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Garland Fervorino, and we're talking about his book, Our Nation Betrayed. Pick up the story there, Garland.
Well, the Iraq, I guess maybe we should talk a little bit about the Iraq invasion. I did some research on that, and just in case anybody thinks that we're actually doing something good over there, the CIA produced a 2002 National Intelligence Estimate, and in that document there were 32 statements in the summary statement. I found 20 of them to be false, 7 deceptive, and only 5 unarguably true. So they had completely, that was not a mistake. That was a document that was written deliberately to deceive both the citizens and particularly the various government officials into invading a country under false pretenses. Now the question is, did the CIA just do that on their own, or did they give the president and the vice president exactly what the doctor ordered? And if you go back to, you'll find, look at the Project for New American Century, what we find out there is that there were some people advocating the invasion of Iraq under false pretenses back in 98.
Now, before you do that, you really should tell our listeners, what is the Project for the New American Century?
Well, that's quite an interesting thing too, because it's not really clearly defined, but it's an organization of different individuals who have come together for political purposes. They're all very, very elite group of individuals.
Who are these individuals? How many are there?
The exact count, I am not
25.
Sure. I think there was just a couple dozen. I was going to say a couple dozen.
Right. Well, the 2 dozen, 24, there were 25 of them. So there were 25 people who got together in 1997, and, of course, they had an objective. What was the objective?
Well, I think the objective was essentially to gain control of the Middle East and the assets there by using Arab military for inappropriate purposes.
Well, Chris, you can go up on their website. I know you have. It's, their website is newamericancentury.org. That's www.newamericancentury.org. Look up their statement of principles, and they will tell you their reason they were formed was to form a new international order to protect our security, our position, and our profits. That was the purpose of this organization. 25 people, just happens that the 17 of them were from the Council on Foreign Relations. And this is a little cabal, and it is a cabal, that they set out in 1998, as Calendar said. Their plan in 1998, they wrote a letter, it's up on their website, to President Clinton saying, in effect, we've got to attack Iraq. Well, this would really not be so significant unless you know who those people are. Who are some of the members of the Project for the New American Century?
Well, probably the most famous four that people will recognize right off the bat would be Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz,
John Bolton, the Gordon Elliott Abrams, Liddy, who's the chief of staff. I mean, there's only 25 people. They control the government. That's the most amazing thing. And the fact that the average American doesn't know this is simply a reflection of the degree of control that exists of what the American people think. Okay, Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Garland Pepperito. We're talking about his book, Our Nation Betrayed. He's talking about, of course, the part that the group, a little group of people, 25 people, including Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld, and certainly Richard Perle, although Perle was not an original member, but he was very quickly associated with him. These are the people who in 1997, 1998 were planning on going to war with Iraq. They took over control of the Bush administration. Nobody's ever asked how or why, but they wanted a war with Iraq. The only reason thing that they needed was an excuse for going in. So pick up the story from there, Garland.
And that's exactly what they did. Sandy, of course, as you know, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney were the key. These people all moved into key Defense Department positions, and even the Vice President of the United States. And they, almost single-handedly, justified this invasion, pushed for it until they actually got it.
And I think the most amazing thing is any of our listeners can read the book by Paul O'Neill called The Price of Loyalty. That The Price of Loyalty, I think it's page 96, where Paul O'Neill tells about going to a national security meeting in February, either January or February of the year 2001, 7 or 8 months before the September 11th attack. And what are they talking about? I mean, the danger of communist China, the danger of Russia, the danger in the Caribbean or Taiwan Straits. No, they're talking about how are we going to go to war with Iraq? How are we going to divide up the oil in Iraq? How are we going to get the American people to justify or to agree to a preemptive strike on Iraq 7 to 8 months before the 9/11 attack? And then, of course, you read their website. It's called newamericancentury.org. That's newamericancentury.org. And you find out who these people were that they started planning this in 1998, waiting for some sort of a catastrophic and catalyzing event that would justify doing what they wanted to do. Those are their words. It comes from something on their website called Rebuilding America's Defenses. They were looking for an excuse to permanently station American troops in the Middle East. Those are their words, not mine. It's all on their website, specifically in the treatise on Rebuilding America's Defenses. So pick up the story, Colin.
Well, it is truly amazing, as you just said, Stan, that They really just come right at you with it. There's no secret. They just advocate exactly what they want to do and have the power to do it. They don't even have to hide in secrecy. So, that is quite amazing. And then, by the time they pull this off, it takes a while for the, most of the people in America to realize that, oh, the evidence was not, it was never there to begin with. So I just went through and documented about 30 different lies that the various people in the administration have told to justify this invasion.
Well, you've got a great list. What are some of those lies they've told?
Well, let's take the key point. Probably, if I had to summarize them all, would be the testimony of Colin Powell at the UN Security Council. Now, what most people in America haven't really been told is that the weapons inspectors on March 7th refuted virtually every charge that Colin Powell made against Iraq. This was 12 days prior to the invasion. So every nuclear charge was found to be false. Every chemical and biological charge was found to have no, could not be substantiated. Now, so there wasn't a mistake there. It was every single charge was found by a bevy of 600 weapons inspectors on the ground in Iraq 6 months prior to the invasion to be unsubstantiated or just blatantly false, as in some cases, like the Nigerian yellowcake charge. That was even actually had documents forged and falsified to support that. So I would probably point to that one, that to me is the key charge, because the American people are led to believe, well, this could have been just a mistake. But in reality, it was planned, as you said, Stan.
And, of course, the CIA has come out and said, we didn't tell them they had any weapons of mass destruction. So when the CIA refused to tell them they had weapons of mass destruction, they set up their own agency there under a man named Douglas Feith, and they came up with false information. Oh, well, if not intentionally, you have to understand. It was just a mistake, and 1,000 American boys have died, and there are 30,000 casualties as of this date. 30,000 casualties. American boys either wounded or have serious illnesses going to the Veterans Administration trying to get treatment. Don't you worry, no treatment is available. Why they're 300,000 cases behind in providing treatment for veterans here. And well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I was just saying there were 300,000 cases that 300,000 veterans now are trying to apply for veterans benefits, and the Veterans Administration is so hopelessly behind. Now, apparently, our men are able to get into the veterans' hospitals, but, of course, when they get in there, unless they have a wound of some sort, they've lost an arm or a leg, they're just not bothering to treat any of them. They're certainly not treating for examining for depleted uranium. In fact, the VA has been ordered not to test for depleted uranium. Why? Because most of them, or I suspect a significant number of them, are infected, have been contaminated with depleted uranium, and the last thing they want American people or our soldiers to know is they're being sent over to be contaminated with a very active form of uranium poisoning, both chemical and, of course, radioactive, and many of them will eventually die. The results of that, certainly we know from Major Rocky's testimony. He was in charge of the Army's effort to clean up American vehicles, both tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles were contaminated accidentally. Now, during the first Gulf War, and I have an article where Major Rocky, who commanded 100 men, had commented that some 30% of those men are already dead. Young, healthy American boys exposed to depleted uranium. So, and Major Rocky himself is dying from his exposure, trying to awaken the American people. But I wonder when the last time you read an article in the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Washington Times or the Wall Street Journal about Major Rocky and depleted uranium that is being used to poison not only the people of Iraq, but the American troops stationed there. Pick up the story from there, Garland.
Well, that's a great point, Stan, and you also have talked about the Gulf War syndrome as well, and, I mean, you could devote probably a week full of shows about the Gulf War syndrome and quite a few shows about the depleted uranium that has you know, he's been laid down in Iraq. So it's just really very disgusting to think that our tax dollars have gone to kill people unjustly.
And to kill our own boys. That's what's so tragic. And within the last 10 days, why, there's a special new report on Gulf War, and they say, oh, shucks, we've been wrong all this time. These boys were crazy. We're giving them Prozac. They really were. There really is a Gulf War illness related to the toxins that they encountered and neurotoxic, and we're now beginning to find this out. But all this time, they've been lying to the American people. Why? Because they wouldn't dare let the American people know that 697,000 young men, almost half of them, are ill, and many of them have died. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We're talking about the latest report on the Gulf War illness. Just came out within the last 10 days. A 150-page report reported in the New York Times. We have the article. And they're admitting now that there really is a Gulf War illness. And about, they say about 30% of the Gulf War veterans, that would be about 200,000 are ill. The figures we get is well over half of them. But we know over 10,000 of them have died. These are young, healthy people. Young, healthy people don't die. But over 10,000 of the Gulf War veterans that we sent over, you know, in 1990, 1991, 13, 14 years ago, over 10,000 are dead. And they admit to 30% are ill. I believe it's probably 50 or 60% are actually ill. But whether it's 30% or 60%, why would we keep denying these men were ill when they kept all had the similar symptoms? And, of course, all they ever got was, of course, Cinequin, was some sort of mood stabilizer or Prozac. Pick up the story from there, Garland.
Well, that's right, Stan. You've covered it very, very well. And it's just sad for me to think that these boys are not getting the treatment that they need to get because the government wants to cover up what they've done. After these boys have served our country, men and women, in fact, they're just not getting any treatment.
And so many of them, for instance, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, so-called Lou Gehrig's disease, now they're finally accepting them as service-connected because there's such a high incidence among the boys we sent overseas to fight for freedom.
Stan, one thing you mentioned earlier in the show that I thought we might be interesting to cover, because of the election coming up, we were talking about Skull and Bones. I was going to change subject for you and go back there just for a minute. We talked about the Bush side and how they facilitated the Skull and Bones agenda. But I have a couple items that might be of interest to the audience, because I know they're so well-versed already, but there might be a couple things that they don't know about John Kerry and how John Kerry has also facilitated the agenda while appearing to actually oppose George W. Bush. And probably many people know that they actually have very similar voting records. Kerry voted to invade Iraq. He voted for the Patriot Act, which is suppressing a lot of our freedoms. He's supported a lot of the treaties that have outsourced jobs, you know, like GATT and NAFTA, to different countries and reduced American sovereignty and made it subordinate to this one world government, new world order that the Bushes have wanted to rein in. And a lot of people might be aware of that, some are not, but there's also a lot of covert things that John Kerry has done to support the Bushes ever since he was an assistant DA in Massachusetts. And I thought maybe we could, this might be of interest to you, but I've had a couple of points that I just kind of tracked back his career, because, you know, if you're both Skull and Bones, then you should be supporting the same agenda. And sure enough, when I found out that John Kerry has actually protected the Bushes in three key cases, one in assistant DA in Massachusetts, and two while he was heading Senate investigations. The first one in Massachusetts involved Operation Watchtower, which was another military drug operation that ran from Colombia into Panama. And one of the fellows who actually read my book wrote me and said he knew about this operation, was actually involved in it to a degree. And he basically, what they were doing, they had beacons set up, and they would run planes from Colombia into Panama, where they would land, and the Noriegas would take the drugs, pick up the drugs, and distribute them from there. And
now, who was running this? Who was actually involved in that operation? Was this a CIA operation? Was this a military operation? What?
It was an SAG-7, SAG-10. Operation.
What's SAG stand?
I think this was actually a special forces operation.
Well, of course, special forces would be working with the CIA then, because the special forces are really, in many respects, an extension of the Central Intelligence Agency. They're just people who are trained assassins. They're very, very skilled soldiers. And what's the purpose of a soldier? His soldier is to kill. And they train them to kill. And but we know that in many instances, why the CIA and the special forces have worked together. The Afghan War was the initial stages was a CIA war. Of course, most of the troops on the ground were special forces, although there were armed CIA troops there as well. In fact, the Iraqi war is really a CIA-run war. The military are there, but there are lots of course, these private contractors you hear about. They're all CIA. They're CIA operators. Many of them are sheep dipped. They're former SEALs, former Special Forces, former Delta Force, working over there as civilians. But they're not really civilians. They're carrying out the CIA directives. Because Vietnam was a CIA war. Afghanistan was a CIA war. Iraq is a CIA war. And the drug smuggling was a CIA operation, and I suspect Operation Watchtower was a CIA operation. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, I think that's an excellent analysis, and you're right. And the CIA wars and drug trafficking tend to go together. So, for example, in Vietnam, at the same time we were over there, the CIA was had set up their drug operations running from Burma into Laos. While we were in the Vietnam War, so they had that covert operation going on, and a conflict and a drug operation seemed to go hand in hand, decade after decade throughout the world. And so this particular operation, Operation Watchtower, I think you're absolutely correct, because at that time, this was the exact instant that, George, H.W. Bush was heading the CIA in 1976, and, the connection to Kerry is that Kerry's office filed false murder charges against Private William Tyree, who was trying to expose this operation. He and his wife, Elaine, who was working for the Army Criminal Investigative Division, were exposing Watchtower, and Elaine was killed, and they actually know who did it, and one, the fellow who has actually committed the murder was put away, but in the process of that, Kerry's office filed false murder charges against Elaine's husband, Private William Tyree. He ended up in jail, convicted of a murder that he did not actually commit, and the fellow who did commit the murder eventually wrote a sworn statement that Tyree was not involved in. But Tyree has spent probably how many years exactly, 15 years or more in jail for murder that he did not commit, because he was trying to uncover and reveal this operation.
You're suggesting that John Kerry was covering for a CIA operation?
And I think it's a very safe to bet to say that John Kerry is CIA.
Well, I think that people have to understand that the Skull and Bones has a whole section in the CIA. There's a very, very close relationship between the Skull and Bones and the CIA. And if you do any reading or studying about the Skull and Bones, you'll find that so many of the members of Skull and Bones go to work for the CIA. People man who was the first publisher of National Review, a man named William Buckley.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Bundy brothers, George,
yeah,
and McGeorge Bundy and his brother, they were all, of course, involved with the CIA. And, of course, so it wouldn't be at all surprised that that Kerry would be covering for a CIA operation when he was acting as an assistant district attorney.
That's a great point. And Richard Bissell as well, the deputy director of CIA plans for the Bay of Pigs operation, was also a Bonesman. And of course, as you mentioned, with George Bundy, the National Security Advisor to Kennedy, also during the Bay of Pigs, was a bondsman. But I thought that was one intriguing play, type of a connection where Kerry has actually covered up for Bush. So I think it's important for everyone to understand the concept of controlled opposition. So here we are led to believe that Kerry and Bush are opposites. Here's one case where Kerry has actually protected the Bushes.
Of course, this was Daddy Bush. It wasn't George.
That's right, George H.W. Bush.
But then one bonesman always has to cover for another bonesman. They always do. They are part of a secret society. They're sworn and bonded to one another.
Exactly. And just to go on with two more examples that I think you might find interesting. In the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Kerry was responsible for a 1986 investigation into CIA drug trafficking allegations that had been raised. Basically, the investigation never really reached any substantive conclusions, even though it actually admitted that most of the evidence against the CIA that was collected was in fact true. They, of course, still denied that the CIA had involvement, and the furthest that it went was that the CIA turned a blind eye to drug trafficking, not that they were actually involved in and controlling the operations. So Kerry was responsible for that investigation, and again, this was an investigation, as you mentioned earlier, Stan, the Iran-Contra, which people think was about arms for hostages, was really about drugs for money, when you really get down to looking at all the details. And Kerry was able to help keep the focus on the arms for hostages facade and keep it off of the drug money aspects, which actually I found out later that, for example, Ali North was indicted in Costa Rica for drug trafficking. And back then, North was one of my heroes. I thought he was a great guy. So my opinion has changed a little bit since then. So that was another example of Kerry, from the position of controlled opposition, protecting the Bushes. And particularly that was while George H.W. Bush was vice president of the United States in the 80s.
Now, let me, for our listeners out there who may find this very difficult to believe, if you go to the website, to the Wilderness, there's a link there to the CIA website where the Inspector General of the CIA talks about CIA agents involved in drug smuggling. That's To the Wilderness. We'll link you to the CIA website, at least last time I checked it. There was the Inspector General report on CIA, certain agents' involvement in drug smuggling. Were any of them ever fired? Were any of them ever punished? Were any of them ever imprisoned? Why, to my knowledge, none of them ever were. We actually pulled that down. We have that ourselves. Of course, it would be quite a job to copy it for you. You can get it all yourself. We have a four-tape set. Is they're really out of war on drugs? That's the title. Is there really a war on drugs? You'll hear people from the DEA and INS telling you how the CIA has been involved in drug smuggling. We have Rodney Stitz's book, Drugging America, going to the CIA's involvement in drug smuggling. Defrauding America by Rodney Stitz. The CIA involvement in drug smuggling. Well, if the CIA is involved in drug smuggling, whether the Republicans or the Democrats are in power, does that make you concerned if you're out there in the listening audience? Don't you think you really need to check the facts and find out if it's really true? Because if it really is, it means that we have evil people working at the highest echelons of both political parties. And, of course, there are consequences when the good people do nothing. For all that is necessary for evil to triumph, is that good people do nothing, and the price that good people pay for their apathy and indifference to public affairs is they end up being ruled by evil men and eventually being enslaved. So pick up the story from there, Garland. Well, before we go on, though, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get copies of your excellent book, Our Nation Betrayed, From Impeachment to Infinite War.
Well, thank you very much, Dan. I appreciate that. They could just simply call 888-808-5440 and ask for, Tony will answer, and she would love to take an order. 888-808-5440. We also including some new electronic reports on the election 2004, Skull and Bond. So if you want to give her your email address, she'll be glad to send you those reports complimentary.
Now, do you have a website?
Yes, blackforestpress.com. In the law and politics section, you can find it there if you prefer to order through the web. That would be www.blackforestpress.com. And if you look under the law and politics, you'll find this book at the top of the list.
Okay, go ahead.
You had mentioned, saying that about From the Wilderness, and Michael Rupert, this is a quick aside before we get back to the last point I was going to make, but Michael Rupert and I met during the impeachment, and we had come to the exact same conclusion from different areas. Of course, Michael, you know, runs that the site From the Wilderness, and he had uncovered what I think is a key piece of evidence in why the Republican Party sabotaged the impeachment of Bill Clinton by never bringing the real evidence forward, and then sabotaging the trial procedures in the Senate, and also not calling any hostile witnesses against the president. But Michael had recognized that 1 hour after the House voted to begin the impeachment inquiry was when the Bill Clinton introduced the CIA Inspector General Volume 2 report on drug trafficking allegations.
In other words, what you're suggesting is that everybody's attention was focused on the impeachment hearings, and of course nobody looked at the CIA Inspector General's report on the CIA's involvement in drug smuggling.
Exactly.
That is a pretty horrifying thing to think that our central intelligence agency that is formed to protect the American people would be involved in something as terrible as drug smuggling, destroying the lives of hundreds of thousands of young blacks and Hispanics, and certainly of whites as well, but it's predominantly blacks and Hispanics. It's almost as if we had targeted blacks and Hispanics. Because today, almost a third of the young black men in America are either in prison or on probation, run control. Do you think that happened just by accident? I'll pick up the story there.
No, you're absolutely right, Stan. And I think one more point in relationship to all this, in regards to the drug trafficking, the Kerry Bush connections, and the controlled opposition, would be the POW-MIA recovery efforts. John Kerry and John McCain have been instrumental for decades in covering up the fact that we left a couple of thousand POW-MIAs in Southeast Asia at the end of the Vietnam War. And that was also connected to drug trafficking, because as I mentioned earlier, the CIA was running drugs from Burma into Laos towards the end of the Vietnam War. And Kerry was unable to find anything about that either.
Well, there's so much to the story, certainly. John Kerry is a disreputable disgrace as a human being. He had covered up the fate of the POWs, and we did a program just last night with Jerry Mooney, formerly on the staff of the NSA, going into that. But then, of course, George Bush has done nothing for for the POWs, and he sent our boys off to fight and die in a war in Iraq. That is simply an introduction to World War III. Well, I guess this evening has been Garland Favorito, and of course we're talking about his book, Our Nation Betrayed, and it's an excellent book. I've really enjoyed it. And Garland, I hope you'll be willing to come back onto our programs, because we've only really scratched the surface of what you've covered. And of course, so much of this I lived through. I personally was involved with certain aspects of this, and many of the people you talk about, like Pat Matriciano and John Hillier, and I've been very, very close to them through the years. I was to John Hillier until, of course, he mysteriously died at the age of 35 in perfect health. But then, of course, he would had warned people that he knew they were out to kill him. Why? Because he was exposing what the president was doing, President William Jefferson Clinton, but there was a trail of death associated with Clinton. Probably 60 to 100 people died very mysteriously. The names of Ron Brown and Vince Foster, and of course John Hillier, and of course we don't have time to go into the whole list of people, but Jim McDougal, who is going to turn state's witnesses and testify against William Clinton, and of course Ken Starr, rather than give him witness protection, left him in prison, where he died under very, very strange circumstances. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners this evening?
Well, that's right, Stan. I documented about 55 of those deaths in my book. But I think my parting thought would be, the most important thing to understand is the controlled opposition. When you, as you've mentioned earlier, that when you have a Skull and Bones, we have two people who many people believe are actually opposites, Kerry and Bush. In fact, they are all sworn allegiance to the Skull and Bones. They're actually facilitating the agenda, and this whole thing about being opposites based on conservative liberal boundaries is a facade to cover up what they're really doing covertly.
Well, I agree with you totally, and I think that people have to understand it's like Amos and Andy, Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello, Lewis and Martin. But it's a great show, the greatest show on earth. It's about time people understood that we're being betrayed, but behind everything going on are the spirits of forces which energize the members of Skull and Bones and of all the other secret societies. We'll talk more about that. Garland, thank you so very much for being with us. We'll look forward to having you on some of our other programs in the very near future.
Thank you, Stan. It's been a real honor to be with you tonight.
All right. Bye-bye. And
bye.
Good night. Okay. Well, our guest has been Garland Favorito. His book is Our Nation Betrayed, of Recent History of the United States. Excellent material in it. I'm fascinated in reading it. I'm sure you will be as well. We may carry the book ourselves. But we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the first hour of this evening's Radio Liberty program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you listen to our programs and you think there's a problem, we hope that many of you will really seriously consider helping us. This is coming towards the end of the year, and we'd like, of course, to end up the year in the black rather than the red. So if you believe there's a problem and you'd like to be part of a movement that is spending 5 hours every day on radio and of course on shortwave and on the internet and on satellite, but it's an expensive proposition, give a serious consideration to calling us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We'll be glad to send you a newsletter, send you a catalog, and then if you'd like to get in touch with us, well, perhaps even join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, we'd love to hear from you. Now, we earlier mentioned, of course, the CIA's involvement in drugs. That is covered in a book, an excellent book we carry, entitled Into the Buzzsaw by Kristen Borgensen. It's covered in the book Drugging America by Rodney Stitz, Defrauding America by Rodney Stitz. It's covered certainly in the four tape set entitled Is There Really a War on Drugs? So that's Into the Buzzsaw, Drugging America, Defrauding America, the four tape set on Is There Really a War on Drugs? And then if you want to get into Skull and Bones, we have the unique things. We have a four tape set on Skull and Bones. Nobody has anything quite like it. We have a book entitled The America's Secret Establishment, written by my good friend Professor Anthony Sutton before he passed away. And, of course, this goes into the satanic foundation of this. And, of course, the people at Yale have always felt this was a satanic organization. And yet two presidential candidates are coming from this organization. We carry the book The Secrets of the Tomb, written by Alexandra Robbins, certainly written very recently, supposedly with testimony from people who've been in Skull and Bones. I think there's a great deal of false information there, but there's a great deal of good information in it as well. I think Alexandra should be congratulated for the book. I believe, of course, that she talked to people who've been into the tomb, maybe doing decorating or painting, and the Nazi swastikas and the Nazi memorabilia. there, where, of course, both of our presidential candidates matriculated, and the Skull and Bones goes back to a secret occult organization that existed in Bavaria in 1832, and there is where so much of the occultism that was the forerunner of the Nazi Party came from. We carry the book Fleshing Out of Skull and Bones. We even have, from Skull and Bones itself, the membership list and bibliography of the people going back to the year 1833 when the first class graduated. We got this, of course, from the daughter of a member of Skull and Bones. Nobody's supposed to have this information. It's available from Radio Liberty. That's the membership list, either the 1977 or the 1983 membership list. And, of course, it includes the names of, well, all of the Bushes, and there have been about six Bushes, members of Skull and Bones, and then, of course, the Kerry, John Kerry, and so many of the key people in our government, in every level of government, have come from Skull and Bones. So this information is available from Radio Liberty. We want to supply you with the information so you'll have it available so that you can utilize this to help us expose what's going on. Then we want to remind you about our meeting. It's going to be on the 6th of November, all-day meeting, starting at about 8:45, going through to 5. Lunch will be served. Bringing in outside speakers, should be a great meeting. Our annual Radio Liberty Seminar. Give us, if you're coming, give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and please invite your friends. If they don't understand what's going on, bring them, and hopefully we'll be able to convince them there's a real problem and recruit them into this epic struggle to determine whether this nation, or any nation conceived under God, can long endure. And then we ask you to pray for America and to pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, of course, will be back for the next hour for those who can stay with us, but if you're leaving us, till tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. Well, the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And of course we welcome your calls, but please hold them for the time being. We hope to have with us very, very soon Barrett Schoes, who's certainly one of my favorite guests, and she's going to be talking about the preparation for world government. And, of course, if you haven't been to Barrett's website, you should be there. It's called of crossroad.to. That's crossroad.to. And Barrett has some of the greatest information up there on the church growth movement, on what's happening to education. In fact, we carry her book, The Brave New Schools. If you haven't read that, you really need to understand how they are using our education to destroy our children's faith in God and in family and country, to prepare them for the coming world citizenship, because this is the common denominator behind everything. There is a plan, it's been here for a long, long time, to bring about a new world order, to bring about a new world economy, to bring about a new world currency, to bring about a new world religion. And it really all goes back to the writings of Plato in his Republic. Plato was deeply involved with the occult, as was his predecessors, both Socrates and Pythagoras, as was Plato's student Aristotle, as was Aristotle's student Alexander the Great. And we simply have quoted in the past from the book Life of Alexander. I think it was Plutarch's Life of Alexander, where, of course, it goes into the relationship between Alexander the Great and his teacher Aristotle. And Alexander is criticizing Aristotle for writing a book about the mysteries and the mystery religions and the secrets that he had been taught. And saying, how could you possibly write this out? I mean, it is because I know the secrets and I know the understand the mysteries. I have the ability to control other men. And once the other men understand this, why will I have lost my power? And Aristotle writes back and says, of course, if you, you don't understand unless you've been instructed in the mysteries, unless you've been instructed in the secrets, other people cannot understand it. You can read all the books you want to. You'll never understand what this is about. Now, that's really quite true. Unless somebody points out to you what this is about, why you cannot fathom it, because it is beyond the human comprehension that anything could be this evil. But how do you think it was that Alexander the Great, with a small band of 35,000 Macedonians, was able to take on the army of hundreds of thousands of men under Darius with platoons of elephants, and why he had help? He had help from the mysteries, from the secrets. Well, it all goes into creating this world government, and with us this evening is Barrett Schoes. Hi, Barrett. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. It's great to be back with you again. And I think I need to read the book you were talking about.
Oh, it's Plutarch's The Life of Alexander.
So do you spell that one, too?
Plutarch, no, we don't, but
okay.
I think I have an extra copy. If I do, I will try to, I will hope my wife remembers to tell me to send it to you, because there's nobody I would rather have than you having a copy
of that. I want to understand what's going on.
Scott Hively, it's translation by Scott Hively. I think I have an extra copy, and if we do, we'll get it to you.
Okay.
Anyway, of course, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Barrett Schoes as we begin trying to understand this preparation that's taking place in America today for world citizenship. And of course, when you become a citizen of the world, you are no longer a citizen of the United States. And the constitutional guarantees that have separated America from the rest of the world will simply become a remembrance of things past. Okay, Barrett, well, why don't you pick up the story for this evening?
Well, we're going to talk about homeland security.
All right.
And how it views homeschooling families. And I don't mean to totally generalize what's happening with that title, but I'm sure many of our listeners read in the newspapers or heard, I guess it wasn't in the mainstream media, but if you were receiving information through Christian channels on the internet, you would have heard what happened not long ago in Muskego, where you had, the Department of Homeland Security sponsored a mock assault on the school bus. The fictitious terrorist who supposedly planted a bomb on the school bus were portrayed as a group of homeschooling radicals. And the Homeland Security Agency had called them RACOs, against schools and education. Homeschooling families were RACOs, terrorists, who supposedly were behind a bus being exploded, turned over, lying on its side, full of bloodied children. Now, this was actually a drama that was played out in order to train hospital workers and educators and children in emergency plans. And so they weren't actual terrorists, but they had to create a story behind it in order to make it seem real to all the people who were involved. And so they, again, identified the terrorists, the supposed terrorists, as homeschooling families who hated the public school system.
Why not? What would have happened if they'd had this as a group of homosexuals who wanted to disrupt the public school system? Think of these. Sure, that would have managed. Why would they have picked homeschoolers rather than homosexuals or maybe communist terrorists or Al-Qaeda or something like that? Wouldn't Al-Qaeda be a better target to format focus hatred on than homeschoolers? Or do you think maybe they want to focus hatred on homeschoolers?
Well, you know, if it had been homosexuals or Muslims, it would be politically incorrect, wouldn't it? There would be a great deal of opposition. We would hear a lot in newspaper about how this would have been a hate crime, just dramatizing this kind of an act using Muslims or homosexuals or any other protected group in this nation. Not that Muslims are officially protected, but they're becoming protected in many different ways in our country.
Well, why don't you hold that thought for just a minute, because we're going to be pulling all of our other stations back online, and we want them to understand what we're saying. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Barrett is telling about this place in Muskogee that they were having a drill for Homeland Security, and so they were feigning that a school bus had been bombed and overturned by a group of homeschoolers, wacko homeschoolers. And this was a scenario that they sort of made up, but it was just a practice run. But the question is raised, why would they say that homeschoolers would be attacking a bus full of school children? What impression are they going to leave in the minds of the school children, of the people working in the emergency facilities, working in the hospitals, working in the schools? Why would they focus hatred on homeschoolers? Why wouldn't they have an Al-Qaeda or some other terrorist group? And, of course, pick up that story there. What was the response of the homeschoolers in the area?
Well, they were very upset. And one of the first groups to complain, of course, and I don't mean complain in a negative sense here, to cry up and say, this is unfair. This is manipulation. It shouldn't be happening. Was the Homeschool Legal Defense Group in Michigan. They quickly gave a report, both a report complaint to both the school system and to the Homeland Security that had written this particular scenario. Actually, it was a man by the name of Daniel Stout who was in charge of this particular. He had written the story. He was a chief deputy for emergency services with the Muskegon County.
How about maybe the Satanists have done it? They could have done it, or the witches might have done it, or some other group like that, but I guess we wouldn't want to offend them.
No. I think what we need to go back to now is to think in terms of the mental health plan that's been falling into place since back in the 30s. We can go back to the 30s and 40s when you had various psychiatric or psychological leaders. You had Brock Chisholm in Canada, and we've talked about this before. You had Reese at the Tavistock Institute in Great Britain, and you had Dr. Sullivan and others working with Rockefeller money in the 30s and 40s, doing research on military men, on their soldiers, their respective soldiers in those countries, to see how they could manipulate the behavior of the masses. And so you had the United Nations founded in 1945 in San Francisco. First head was Alger Hiss, who had actually an international communist magazine, which published an article by Brock Chisholm, Dr. Brock Chisholm, who was the first head of the World Health Organization, which wasn't founded yet, but he had written an article from Canada talking about how Christian parents provide poisonous certainties for their children so that the children have this sense of right and wrong, moral values, and that doesn't work in a society. If you're going to create peace around the world, you can't have moral absolutes, you can't have biblical absolutes, those poisonous certainties fed to the children. So parents have to be controlled, children have to be controlled in order to create the kind of mental health that will help establish the controlled world of the 21st century, where there will be no more wars, everyone will live in peace together in this utopian world. Well, almost right after the founding of the World Health Organization, you had a international mental health organization, actually a network which involved nations around the world, where each nation would have their own commission on mental health or group on mental health, and they would have annual conventions and so on. This has been going on up until our time. Back in 1948, they were talking about how they had to change the atmosphere of the world to make the new ideas more acceptable. And of course, the media and schools, universities have done a very good job of creating that atmosphere where the new globalist ideals are now acceptable. And we have to see that within Homeland Security, even under a Republican president, we have a Homeland Security that up until has incorporated the FBI, CIA, and so on, and up until just a few years ago put out a flyer in Arizona that called people to help identify potential terrorists, such as, and then it presented those potential signs of somebody who might be a terrorist. They would be loners, they would be people who talked a lot about the Constitution. In other words, they were patriots, and it referred to super patriots. People like us, Dr. Stan, were being held up as those people who might potentially be a terrorist, and therefore, in order to prevent domestic terrorism, you had to look to see who are the ones that don't go along with the program, who resist the public school system, who don't want to go along with the new assessments and so on that test children's attitudes and beliefs and values rather than just academics. And so homeschoolers would be a perfect candidate to be made part of. I mean, in other words, this particular scenario meets two goals. It provides a theme for the acting out of a terrorist situation, and it helps link homeschooling families to somebody who's anti-American, who might cause problems.
And of course, this is all part of their mind control. It is to turn people against those who really want to maintain our freedom, and of course, they become the enemies of the state. And right. There really is an organized, orchestrated effort. In fact, up on my webpage, RadioLiberty.com, we have a copy of the flyer that was put out by the terrorist network, or wherever it was there, in the Phoenix area. What's the title of it?
Well, it was put out
it
by...
It was a task force. It was a terrorist task force in Phoenix.
FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. Which now is part of Homeland Security.
And this was put out in 1999, immediately before the millennium. And they were talking about how you would identify a terrorist. Now, they sent this to the local sheriff's office. They sent it to the local police force. The FBI sent this out. And how could you tell a terrorist? Why, they talk about the Constitution. They certainly were religious fanatics. They were people who, I'm sure you have the list of the things. I haven't read that in some time, but we have it up on our webpage. It's so important. Now, this is 1999. They knew that Al-Qaeda was here. They knew it was operating. The Phoenix office was actually investigating the Islamic terrorists. And not one word about Islamic terrorism in that task force report, drawing the attention of the police and the sheriff's office to the threat of terrorism. The real terrorists were those who talked about the Constitution, who talked about constitutional rights, and of course who opposed all these ideas of world governments. It's most incredible document. And, of course, this was actually circulated. I know people who call the people in the local police, who call the people in the local FBI office, and they admitted that they circulated this. Why weren't they warning against the Islamic terrorists? Why were they drawing attention to patriots. They call them super patriots, people who uphold the Constitution.
Well, it's very similar to what happened after the Oklahoma bombing, isn't it? When you had the newspapers, media leaders, and educators were all bringing together, you know, lumping homeschooling families and Christians together with terrorists and saying these are the people who oppose the government.
And, of course, this was all based upon the fact that Timothy McVeigh had attended a couple of so-called patriot organizations or militia meetings, whereas, of course, the real force behind Timothy McVeigh were a group of Islamic terrorists. And the government knew that John Doe 1 was an Iraqi. They knew exactly who he was. And John Doe 2 was an Iraqi. And John Doe 3 was an Iraqi. And, of course, Terry Nichols had gone to the Philippines to meet with Ramzi Yousef, the mastermind of the First World Trade Center bombing, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Murad, and of course Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is today in custody. Ramzi Yousef and Murad are both in prison, but they couldn't let the American people know that. And in fact, the fact, and you can get this from Stephen Jones' book, entitled The Oklahoma City, pardon me, Others Unknown, The Oklahoma City Bombing Conspiracy. That's Stephen Jones' second book, where, of course, the defense from McVeigh opened up with the fact that he had written his sister and said, I am part of a secret special forces unit involved in illegal activity. Jones brought that out. Not one word in the controlled media across America. If any of you would like to see the page from the book, we have that. Isn't it amazing? You could conceal the fact that Timothy McVeigh, who was, of course, obviously working with a group of Islamic terrorists, said he was working for a secret special forces unit. How would you conceal that in America, Barrett, unless you controlled literally all the means of communication?
Right, exactly. It's interesting. That is to be the one quote from Time magazine from 1996, where they wrote, their coalition, talking about those who are against America, their coalition included well-known elements of the far-right thought, tax protesters, Christian homeschoolers, conspiracy theorists, and self-reliant types who resent the federal government that seems to favor grizzly bears and wolves over humans. All were implicated because, of course, they questioned some of the things that were happening in America at the time. But Time magazine lumped Christian homeschoolers together with the militia and those who could genuinely be suspect.
And, of course, you're talking about, of course, the environmental terrorists, but, of course, they're being funded by the great tax-exempt foundations.
Right.
They're being funded by the great corporations. They're being funded by Ted Turner. Who's funded the Christian homeschoolers? Absolutely no one. Because they're the ones who want to protect their children. And, of course, the great corporations and great foundations have been funding a radical environmental movement in America since its inception. And some of these people, like Earth First, are tied into the true environmental terrorists. We'll be right back in just a moment with Barrett Chosen. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Barrett Chosen. And she's talking about how a Time magazine is equating homeschoolers with the environmental radicals and with the militia and other radical groups. So there's an effort to equate homeschooling and those who want to protect their children from the school system, where children know far more about sex than they do about Shakespeare, far more about Marilyn Monroe than they do about mathematics. People who want their children to be brought up in the way of the Lord, to equate them with the militia and the environmental terrorists, who care more about, of course, the wolves and the bears than they do about our government and oppose our government. Well, pick up the story from there, Barrett.
Well, I want to give you one more quote from those days because it was such a good expression. Not good, but it was very telling, very revealing expressions of hostility toward homeschooling families and Christian parents. For example, one of the superintendent of schools in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, his name was Lou Finch, said, there, quote, there is a dedicated, very well organized, very will finance movement in America that's very anti-public schools and very anti-government. The ultimate example of that sentiment is the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City.
Yeah, I didn't know that that Timothy McVeigh was a homeschooler.
No.
Well, you see, ladies and gentlemen, this is what they call guilt by association, that
that's
they were
right.
so critical of Joe McCarthy about, and yet, of course, most of the people he identified as communists actually were communists or communist sympathizers, but now, of course, this guilt by association, when it's turned the other way, where is the media saying, oh, guilt by association, terrible? Of course, they're not going to talk about that. What they're trying to do is create in the minds of the American people, through the medium of print, through television, through radio, the idea of discrediting anybody who does not want their child indoctrinated in sex, who does not want them indoctrinated in immorality, who still believes in God and family and country, because the purpose of education is to destroy belief in God, family, and country. It's
right.
to change, as Barrett had said so well, attitudes, values, and beliefs, and prepare our children for world citizenship. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, it is a fair statement, and it's happening so fast right now. When you see the hostility in the educational establishment, but you see the same strategies that we've resisted in public schools, I mean, and this battle seems to be going on and on because we were fighting this battle for this freedom in schools and against the national assessments and against the kind of assessments, again, that would catch those children who believe in God, who cannot conform to the psychosocial strategies and the consensus process. But their attitudes and beliefs that do not fit the system will be measured again on these new assessments. And so we're going to see Christians, as happened in other countries where there was hostility toward Christianity, become lower citizens because they will not be allowed into various organizations, companies, schools, higher education, and so on. Gatekeepers will not allow those who cannot function, who don't fit their definition and standards for teamwork, for blending minds, for not...
Hold that thought right there, Barrett. Well, this is Dr. Stanback here. Our guest this evening is Barrett Schoss. Her website is crossroad.to. That's crossroad.to. And her treatise is certainly on what's happening in the schools, this idea of course, labeling Christians as being somehow equated with terrorism. The fact that they would put on office Homeland Security terror drill, spading or simulating of the overturning of a school bus, a bomb on a school bus, and the children there laying in the school bus bleeding to have to be cared for, an emergency matter. And of course, the scenario was it was a group of those wacko homeschoolers. It is simply the idea of implanting in people's minds. It is all thought control. They know what they're doing. They're implanting in people's minds that anybody who wants to get the kids out of the government schools where they're destroying their very souls and where they, of course, have taken God out of the schools and replaced it with the teachings of Aleister Crowley, anybody who wants to protect their children, obviously, is some sort of a danger to society. Anyway, Barrett is telling us what happened. Incidentally, Barrett, what happened when the homeschoolers in Muskogee and in the state there wrote to the Office of Homeland Security and complained about this scenario and how, of course, that this is totally unfair, unjust, and to use our tax money to try to discredit the law-abiding citizens like homeschoolers is immoral. What was the government's response?
Well, the superintendent of the Muskegon Area Intermediate School District gave this apology. He said, quote, "The Muskegon Area Intermediate School District shared a disappointment of others when we learned the September 21st, 2004, emergency preparedness drill referenced homeschoolers as the fictitious group responsible for a mock disaster. We apologize. A sample scenario was required in order to receive the necessary funding to stage the event. The Muskegon Area Intermediate School District and our local schools did not construct the scenario, but we participated with other county agencies, hospitals, and emergency responders in conducting the drill. So he did apologize, but then he sort of justifies himself and says he wasn't really to blame because they didn't construct the scenario, even though they were part of creating the scenario. He said that he went on to say this exercise was meant to sharpen the skills and the response time of our emergency services personnel, but was unfortunately clouded by the choice of this fictional group. We sincerely regret offending homeschool educators.
I think that would be very nice. I hope that the homeschoolers got that message out all across the state, did they? Or were they blocked because of the degree of control over the media there? As all across our country, the media is controlled by a group of very, very powerful people who have a different view of the world.
Yeah, I didn't hear any of this over the mainstream media. I'm afraid the only newspaper that carried it was the Muskegon paper. And as far as I know, anyway, there were some editorials written afterwards, such as by Michelle Malkin, who I appreciate. But other than that, I really didn't see very much or hear very much about it. But Daniel Stout, who is the chief deputy for emergency services in that particular county and with the sheriff's department, he also added an apology. He said that, quote, in the world today, homeland security is a very important issue. The training of our nation to respond to the many threats we face is of utmost importance. As part of a full-scale homeland security exercise, I wrote about a fictional group and a fictional scenario for the exercise. This fictional group and scenario made reference to fictional people. Now, he's avoiding giving the name here for a while. Fictional people who are against schools. This fictional group and scenario was not meant to offend any homeschool students. It has nothing to do with any homeschool population. But of course it does. It has everything to do with the homeschool population.
But why, since we are supposedly at war with terrorism, we have a Patriot Act that's all about terrorism, but they never talk about Islamic terrorism. You would think that they would want to talk about Islamic terrorism. They're the threat to America. Or is it people like you and I who believe in God and family and country? Are we the elite? Are we the real enemy?
I think we are, because I think the real goal is not so much to create absolute peace as it is to bring everyone together within this dialectic content where you take opposites and you come together and you're willing to set aside your assumption and discuss, listen to each other, and come up with new conclusions.
And we're not
willing to do that because we're taking a stand on absolute truth.
And of course, these are the techniques that were perfected on the American boys in Korea, the American boys that we abandoned in Korea. Brainwashing techniques have been refined by the communists and then carried over into our schools and into our church growth churches and into a psychiatric care all across America today. We'll be back in just a moment with Barrett Schultz. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Barrett Schultz, and we're talking certainly about this attack on the homeschooling system, but it's really an attack on those of us who believe in absolutes, who believe in right and wrong, who believe our children should be brought up in the way of the Lord, who believe that they should be taught that there are certain things that you should do and there's certain things you shouldn't do, and that the Ten Commandments is the foundation of a successful and happy life. And, of course, that's not what the message is being taught in school. What they're teaching children in school is you determine what's right and wrong. You determine, how you will live your life. That is how you become free. And that, of course, is the basic teaching of Aleister Crowley, who was a Satanist, whose motto was, do what thou wilt, That is the whole of the law. That is what our schools are teaching today. And anybody who loves their children is not sending them to public schools if there's any possible way that they can get them out, no matter how great the sacrifice would be. So with that as the thought, we're going to open up our calls to our lines to callers at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And Barrett, pick up the story from there as you've developed this in this wonderful essay you wrote. What's the title of the essay?
Homeland Security links homeschoolers to terrorists.
Homeland Security links homeschoolers to terrorists. Go ahead, Barrett.
Well, let's again talk about, I'd like to talk about mental health again and go back to some of the statements that have been made that help us understand why homeschoolers are the enemy and why Christian parents who take a stand and question what's going on in education are now considered enemies. And I think one of the statements that clarifies this so well was stated by Corinne McLaughlin, actually written in her book on spiritual politics. Corinne McLaughlin is probably not a familiar name to our listeners, but she was giving a workshop. I heard her speak during the 50th anniversary for the United Nations held in San Francisco at a particular conference called Spiritual Celebration. Robert Mueller, whom we've talked about before, who prepared the World Core Curriculum, was one of the keynote speakers.
For our listeners, though, who do not know who he was, here are many here. He was the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. He was a member of the Lucis Trust. He is a Luciferian, in my opinion. He has written extensively on the need for a world government, this new world order, the new world economic system, the new world religion. So Robert Mueller, mm-hmm. you're talking about there, and what
yes.
about him?
Well, he was one of the keynote speakers, and Corinne McLaughlin was a workshop leader. She told me afterwards she was a friend of Hillary Clinton. I said,
hold that thought for just a minute here. All right, our guest this evening is Barrett Schoss, and of course she's talking about having run into the Corinne McLaughlin. Now, Corinne McLaughlin is certainly nobody I've ever met, but I've read her book, Spiritual Politics, and if you can get it in a secondhand bookstore or an order, get it and read it. It's a very important book because it will introduce you to this whole world of the occult and how it affects politics. From their point of view, from the point of view of the dark side. It's one of the most important books in my library because it's written by the people from the other side who tell you exactly what's going on. And, of course, Barrett had an opportunity to meet Karen McLaughlin at a 50th anniversary celebration of the formation of the United Nations. And what did she tell you other than the fact that she was a friend of Hillary Clinton's?
Well, she also introduced herself as having been the first task force coordinator for the President's Council on Sustainable Development.
That was Bill Clinton's task
force. His Commission on Sustainable Development, which worked directly with the UN Commission on Sustainable Development, which worked with 150 other national commissions on sustainable development. And, of course, what sustainable development is all about is it's the three E's. It's environment, equity, and economy. And what is emphasized the most now, and what publicly was emphasized the most, was we need to take care of the environment. But they've decided, you know, that in order to take care of the environment, you have to change people. And so equity becomes the key objective, which is done by redistributing people through immigration, resources through the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and all the various other ways of aids and so on, to create, to do away with poverty between the North and South, and to get everyone together in their small groups, small diverse groups, which is one of the reasons why the United Nations continually assesses every community in this country and around the world for social capital. Social capital being what is the to what degree are the people participating in community service and in small groups that are diverse and where they're learning to get together across the diverse values, beliefs, cultures and so on.
Now, you mentioned that Corrine McLaughlin had not only been the first task force director for the Sustainable Development Task Force, the Clinton Sustainable Development Task Force, but she'd also been a consultant to a number of other branches of government. This is a woman who's deeply involved in the occult. What is she doing serving as an advisor or to various government departments? What were those government departments?
Well, there was the EPA, the Department of Education, and the Pentagon.
So here this woman who, by her own admission, who's written the book Spiritual Politics, going into what's going on from the occult point of view, from the New Age point of view, is a consultant to the Pentagon, to the EPA?
Well, but maybe not a standard consultant. What she was doing, she is an expert in the dialectic process, in the paradigm shift, in teaching people to... she has an outline of the various things that need to take place, but she talks about teaching community thinking, for example, instead of separative thinking. Familiar thinking, and it's all part of this dialectic process of getting people to dialogue from different sides in the political and social arena.
But it's what it's really is doing away with individualism and replacing it with communitarianism.
They
would, of course, if you were in Russia, you would call it communism. It is a group think rather than an individual, but it's the individual who is created by God, not the group. It's the individual who will accomplish things, not the group. But what they're doing, of course, is to destroy individualism, destroy a belief in right and wrong, and we're to become tolerant of everything, no matter how horrible it is.
Exactly. Because you've done away with moral right and wrongs, biblical right and wrongs. You do have other right and wrongs, but they're the right and wrongs that are determined by the new global goals. In other words, it's right to participate in these groups. It's wrong to be a loner, as we saw in that FBI flyer. And so... all the definitions and values are turned upside down. But I want to just read her statement from her book, Spiritual Politics, because I think it helps us to understand why there's such hatred for Christian parents and for homeschooling families.
Go ahead.
In her book, she says, there really is only one sin, separateness. War is more likely to spring from rampant nationalism, ethnocentrism, and intolerant religious fundamentalism, all extreme and separative attitudes.
And of course, exactly the opposite is the case. I mean, people who are really believe in the Lord aren't going to want to go out and kill other people. Whereas, of course, when you are part of this group think, you naturally go along with it. That's why so many of our young people are willing to go off and kill other people, because our government tells them that we're spreading democracy.
Right. She goes on to ask the question, or she answers her own question, says, what is needed as a cure for separateness is a deep sense of community, that we're all in this together. And I might just mention that this deep sense of community, which is a new view and a new training, transformational leadership that's being used to train workers in team spirit, in companies, to work in teams, to think in teams. But it's happening in schools, it's happening in community groups, and it's happening in churches across the country. This whole new program of 40 Days of Community is teaching exactly the same thing. So it's 40 Days of Purpose, but 40 Days of Community, again, which is just captivating people from around the world. I get letters from all the time from Australia and South Africa, and China even, not about that, but I get letters from China who are reading what we have on our website and who are just, you know, appalled at, again, some of the things that are the same, but also at other things that are happening. But these 40-day programs are spreading throughout what's supposed to be the free world, not in communist countries, and it's training them in transformational Marxism.
Now, you're really talking about the 40 Days of Purpose?
40 Days of Purpose and 40 Days of Community. And I just wrote a new article on 40 Days of Community. And I'm bringing it up because that's exactly what Corrine McLaughlin has in mind.
Now,
to get people together under the facilitators who have been trained in transformational strategies and let everyone, again, the ground rule is, hear your heart, confess everything in your mind, put it out on the table, be tolerant of all the different impressions and responses, and then all of you learn to transcend your differences and accept all the different views. And all of a sudden, you do exactly what Bach Chisholm was talking about 50 years ago. You put aside traditional beliefs and values. There are not many churches who will talk about sin anymore, but they talk about Christianity and salvation and feeling good and God loving us, but they set aside the basis for the cross.
And it reminded me of a recent interview we had with a gentleman. He called in, and we were being critical of certainly the things that are going on in the church today. And he says, well, I did a group of young people, but I've got to modify the message because the things that they don't like to hear about, they don't like to hear about the blood of Jesus Christ. That
right.
offends them, and so we don't talk about that.
Right, and that's because our education system and our media have created the postmodern generation. The postmodern generation with their abhorrence, its abhorrence for absolutes, their acceptance of continual change.
And, of course, if you don't want to bring up the blood of Christ, then how do you explain his sacrifice? How do you explain the fact he was the Lamb of God and lambs were sacrificed? And through the blood came the cleansing. That was the message of the Old Testament. That was the message of the New Testament. But then how do you explain the communion where, of course, you eat of the bread as the body and the wine is symbolic of the blood of Jesus Christ? Of course, it gives us the protection. It gives us the opportunity to salvation. But after all, if you change the message, then to make it more palatable, you've destroyed the message and its significance. And this is what's happening in our churches. And I believe that the 40 days of purpose that is being brought into our churches is part of a movement to transform, as Rick Warren says, not only the church in America, but to transform the world. But how is he transforming? Is he making it to hold our values or the values of people like Corrine McLaughlin?
Well, it comes frighteningly close to what Corrine McLaughlin is writing. The paradigm shift that she's talking about in her book, From Beginning to End, is exactly the paradigm shift that's taking place in the churches. And they very freely embrace the strategies that are being used in corporations. They you can go to Rick Warren's pastor.com website and you find reference to Drucker, of course, because Drucker has been one of Rick Warren's tutors, and he's a communitarian. But also to Peter Senge, who are you familiar? Have you discussed Peter Senge?
No, I really haven't.
He wrote this, what is it called? The fifth, I have it right here somewhere. Anyway, he has established a particular program, organizational learning at MIT. It has organizational in the title. I don't have the book in front of me, I'm actually writing an article. I started an article. I will have this posted on our website within a week. But what he is, I'm paralleling his program, Peter Senge, who sounds like a Buddhist when he talks to Buddhist groups. I read so many of his articles besides, I'm halfway through with his book right now.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Tony, who's calling us from SoCal. And incidentally, if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to participate. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. For those of you who do not understand the church growth movement, it is indoctrinated, taken to their meetings, and recruited into the movement over 350,000 Christian ministers and lay leaders of Christian churches, probably many more than that today. And, of course, it's like an Amway meeting. People come away so enthused, we're going to change the world.
Right.
But, of course, first we're going to have to change the message of the Scriptures. Tony, how are you doing?
Oh, hi, Dr. Stan Barrett.
I have a question for our guest this evening.
Well, I had a question, but I kind of wanted to make a comment.
All right, go ahead.
Well, as you were speaking, I'm just totally reminded of Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God.
Yes, wasn't that a great sermon?
Everything you're talking about is just talking, to me, just extends what's happening in the Church of Christianity or Christendom, and I don't say that in a kindly way, but it is really nothing more than the Church of Laodicea. And if we do not somehow or another have a revival in this country that returns to that sermon of Jonathan Edwards, I just don't really see how there's much hope for redemption of the people in this country unless they return to God in a godly fear.
But, of course, the God that they're returning to is not the God that Jonathan Edwards preached about. And for our listeners out there who do not know who Jonathan Edwards was, he was a great the Calvinist evangelist of the 1740s. I remember the Pilgrims arrived in 1620. Jamestown was settled in 1609. The Pilgrims were here in 1620, and in 120 years, America had been totally depraved, and of course secular Christianity was well on its way to being destroyed. The Harvard University had been taken over and had been turned from a Christian university into a secular university. This was 1740, and Jonathan Edwards came and he gave that same sermon over and over and over again, the sinner in the hands of an angry God. And it had such a profound impact as he talked about God's anger with people. Not the God of love. God is a God of love, but he is also a God of justice and judgment. They've just transformed that today in the modern church as we all come together into this one big happy situation where the Christian can join with the Buddhist and the Hindu and the Muslim and, of course, the people who practice the Shinto religion. We're all one. It's all one God. And, of course, that is Satan's very lie. Tony, what was your question, Barrett?
Well, my question had to do with just something a little bit different, and I was wondering if she's ever heard of something called the Process Church. I know it's a little bit off from this purpose-driven church.
Yeah, it's way off, but it's a legitimate question. Are you acquainted with the Process
Not
Church?
Not enough to talk about it, Dr. Stan.
All right, fine. Well, if you can go up on the website, there are over 3 million of references to the Process Church. If you read my next newsletter, you'll learn all about the Process Church. Two of the most important people affiliated with it, Tony, were David Berkowitz, the son of Sam Keller, and another man named Charles Manson.
Oh. Well, I think in a way this process-driven church was the precursor of this purpose-driven church.
Yeah, that's stretching a little bit.
Well,
that's
not sure.
Satanic.
I'm not sure.
Because the process church is a satanic church.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure, and that's why I was asking.
Okay. I think you're reaching.
Well, like I said, I'm not sure.
Okay.
That's why I was asking.
All right. Here
one comment I do have is that. And this does kind of tie in with a lot of things that you've talked about, Dr. Stan, is that one of the problems that we have and that we face as Americans is our own government. And we have a group of people who have all sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution. And they've taken an oath to God to uphold the Constitution. This is talking about from the FBI all the way down to the IRS and the Justice Department and all of them. And those who have a conscience who have been confronted with the fact that they're not doing it are resigning. For example, Joe Bannister. I know you're familiar with him. I think we need to remind our federal officials and those who have taken this oath to God to uphold the Constitution that if they don't do it, that then they are indeed on that very thin silver stand that keeps them from being the sinner in the hands of the angry God.
All right. How would you respond to what Tony is saying, Barrett?
Oh, I so appreciate what
he... I'll listen on the air.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And incidentally, that was the Process Church of the Final Judgment is the full name of the church Tony's talking about. Go ahead, Barrett.
Yes, and I don't know that much about it because I have not personally researched it. I read a few things, but I don't feel qualified to making a statement, but I so appreciate Jonathan Edwards, and I think the key is that God works with us as individuals. It's individual hearts that are transformed, and each one of us, during this time when it seems that our nation is moving further and further away and embracing various counterfeits, and especially a methodology that belongs to the world and bringing it into the church, along with all those transformational ideas that will prepare communities for the new world order. We need to take a stand. We need to teach our children to follow God. We need to be obedient to Him and just pray for one another and be willing to endure any cost that we might incur for being a disciple of Jesus Christ.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Barrett Schoes. And of course, I think the one thing that we would point out is that we will not stand collectively before God. We will all stand individually before God. What they, of course, want to do is do away with individualism. Everything is collectivism. We all feel good about ourselves. We give up our basic beliefs. We are tolerant of everything. Because there are no absolutes. At least that's what they want us to believe. And once we have accepted that there is no absolute right and no absolute wrong, why, of course, they've got us. We have evolved to the higher plane, as Barbara Mark Sheppard says, the higher plane of consciousness. But, of course, I and Barrett and I believe Tony and I hope many of our listeners are on that lower plane where we believe in the truths of the Bible and the fact that the Bible is the only way to Jesus Christ, the only way, not one of the ways, but the only way to Lord. You've got about 2 minutes to wrap up the program, Barrett.
The name of Peter Senge's book is Fifth Discipline, and so I think many of our listeners will probably have heard of it, and he sets out the whole plan for team leadership, for small group, for the dialectic process, all the various facets that's been picked up by Bob Bruford and the Christian Leadership Network, at least it's supposed to be Christian, and it's all put, concealed as it comes into the churches, and including the various churches that are embracing the purpose-driven life and the 40-day of community. It's the world system and it's transformational. I wanted to read one statement by one of the pastors at the Saddleback since we came on this topic. He says, families need rebuilding. Children do not have a level playing field for every intellectual, social, and emotional development. We are flooded with evidence of the need for societal transformation everywhere we look. Then he refers to Peter Drucker. He says, Peter Drucker in The Age of Transformation said that this age is far from over and predicts it will reach way well into the next century. This time calls for critical mass of transformational leaders. And then he goes on to talk about, this new paradigm for transformational leadership is not just for the marketplace, but also for the local and global movement of Christ, one of the most influential movements for the advancement of the church is the purpose-driven model developed by Rick Warren.
All right, we're going to have to let you go, Bert. It's been fascinating. We'll look forward to having you on again in the near future. Thank you for everything you do.
Thank you so much.
Good night, and God bless you. And, of course, our guest has been Barrett Schoes. Her website is crossroad.to for Tonga. And this is Dr. Stan. We did have a caller, but we did not have time to get him on. Let me suggest you go to Barrett Schoes' website at crossroad.to. That's crossroad, no S, .to for Tonga, and to get her material. She writes and writes beautifully. And then, of course, if you really want to understand this whole purpose-driven movement and the man who's really behind this, is the book Deceived on Purpose. That's Deceived on Purpose, and of course it's written by Warren Smith, and the man who's really behind all of this is Robert Schuller, and of course Rick Warren doesn't want to bring this out, he doesn't want to be honest with his people, he doesn't want people to understand, because many people realize that Robert Schuller is preaching a different type of Christianity, an occult type of Christianity, and until people understand that this is the driving force, certainly Peter Drucker, the others that Barrett has mentioned, are important, but Robert Schuller is the main person behind this, and behind that is this whole occult movement of transforming the Christian church. After all, a direct attack on Christianity only strengthens it and makes martyrs out of the people. But by infiltrating the church from within with the 40 days of purpose and the purpose-driven church, why, they have effectively emasculated and destroyed Christianity, which is the very foundation upon which, the rock upon which America and our freedom are built. So the book, the purpose-driven, deceived on purpose. Then we have a four-tape set on the church growth movement. We have a wonderful video entitled Diaprax in the Church, and it goes into this program that has been used in churches today that has its foundation in the occult, but it is being sold as modern-day Christianity, just much more palatable. To understand the music in our churches, the book, The Crisis in Christian Music, the four-tape set, A Musical Madness. So the four-tape set, Musical Madness, The Crisis in Christian Music. The tape set, The Church Growth Movement, The Apostate Church, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin for the Catholic, to see what's happening to the Catholic Church. Aleister Crowley and his friends, you need to have that. To understand the music that's in our churches, you need, of course, to understand the background of the rock and roll of modern-day music as it has moved away from the traditions of music to where we are today. And the videos, they sold their souls for rock and roll. They sold their souls for rock and roll, either the four-hour version or the ten-hour version. And you'll hear Marilyn Manson, the singer, Ozzy Osbourne singing about Mr. Crowley. Who was Mr. Crowley? Well, he was a Satanist. And who did they sell their souls to? Well, they sold them to the devil, and they knew exactly what they were doing. And they laugh at the people, the children, the adults, who come to their concerts. They understand what it's about. You will see the Beatles albums, and whose picture is there? Aleister Crowley. We have another great book. It's called Fallen Angel. It's the story of Led Zeppelin, the music group, and the most famous and the most popular album of all time, The Stairway to Heaven. It's all about Crowleyism. So that's The Fallen Angel, the book. So much material we have. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you the September newsletter that will explain how the media is controlled and who controls it and where the economy is going. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. You can listen to our program 5 hours a day. For our afternoon program, which is currently heard at 9.430, is going to be changed to 7.535. The afternoon program, as of the 31st, will change from 9.430 shortwave to 7.535. The evening program, the one channel, of which is currently 7.315, will change to 6.095. That's 6.095. And, of course, the other channel, 7.535, will remain the same. Remember our November 6th meeting here. We hope you can come all day Saturday. Call us at 1-800-544-8927. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.